Schools are closed across the country. Some are done for the rest of the academic year. Districts in the St. Louis area and beyond could soon do the same. The shift to online learning for many schools can also reveal the deep economic and racial inequities that characterize schools in our hometown and yours. And we wanted to understand how this sudden change could affect long-standing racial and economic disparities in education outcomes.
We can draw a very stark line between education and housing, health, mortality rates. In short, our very kids' lives are at stake. My goodness, if we don't take a beat to uncover and examine and have conversations about how it's been exposed because of this COVID-19 crisis and respond in a way that is different for kids, this is life or death for some of our babies. This is, their lives are at stake.
I'm Jolian Yang, and from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. To get a broader perspective of how the educational landscape is being impacted by COVID-19, we turn to Sharita Love. She directs EdHub, a local nonprofit that works with educators to solve our region's most entrenched educational issues. We spoke recently on a video chat, and Sharita told me it's hard to get a handle on what sudden school closures will mean for children.
Everybody's in a different place, and everybody's kind of grappling with, okay, what is this new norm? And then what is this going to mean for the rest of the school year? We're in, like, you know, this kind of domino effect of how this is playing out for our schools and institutions.
Even though it's hard to know specifics, Sharita worries that students in under-resourced schools are likely to be the most affected.
What we're experiencing right now, not just as a St. Louis community, but as a country, is really uncovering some stark inequities in our response and how we're attempting to best support students and families. You know, transitioning all of our kids to online learning. How is that possible? How is that supposed to play out in an equitable way? How are early learners, right? Kids in preschool supposed to transition to an online learning platform? That's just not something that is sustainable. And so what does learning and learning loss and learning recovery look like for those group of kids? What about our kids that and families who don't have internet access, right? What about our kids that don't have access to devices where they can get online to learn? What about families who are struggling to now provide because of the loss of a job? And now that they're not working, or now that we've all transitioned, we're supposed to take on, you know, teaching children at the same time. So this just, it's just uncovering so much that we haven't had to think about in this way. And now this is going to either force some very explicit and extreme conversations about how we show up for kids and families, or it's going to force some different ways that we have to start approaching this. It's been mind-blowing to see, one, like, some responses that organizations, schools, and programs are having. Some are doing great, and some of us are, like, really, really struggling because this is not in our wheelhouse of, like, the systems that we're used to being or having in place. It's tough, you know, as someone who is connected, as an organization who is connected at multiple levels of school direct service to administration to programmatic and wraparound services that schools provide. It's really tough to watch and hear some of the responses and ways that we're showing up. That, again, is really, really uncovering some stark inequity in how we approach school and learning.
Sharita points out that shelter-in-place orders aren't being felt evenly as low-wage workers continue to go to work in grocery stores or fast food restaurants. With schools closed, parents and guardians who can't work remotely face the greater threat of exposure to COVID-19 while also trying to keep their children from falling behind.
I was on a call a couple weeks ago about how we're going to get food to students and families who during this crisis. And, you know, some of the recommendations are like, okay, well, can we do busing? Like, can we use our buses to deliver the food? Okay, yeah, we can do that. That sounds like a great idea. And I'm like, okay, well, what about the bus drivers and their families and their kids? Just like we will have children at home with us, they will also have children at home with them. So what does that mean for educating, supporting students, and also just staying safe, well, and healthy, as we're all supposed to be doing? And then on top of that, folks are just losing their jobs because there is no work. And so are you leaning on other family members to educate your children? Are you, again, like coming home from work and working with kids? And so what does that mean for kids? Like, that, it, like again, this is, it is so multi-layered. I do not have the answer to that. Like, what does that mean? And this is something that we just have to think about as this crisis uncovers so much for all of us.
Amid all these pressures for many parents and guardians, Sherita says the shift towards online education isn't likely to lead to equal outcomes.
We're making some assumptions that parents have literacy levels that, you know, are going to best support kids. It's making some assumptions that I have the resources at hand to understand how to apply, use, and even decipher a lot of this information. And it's making some assumptions that I have the schema for how to apply a lot of this information and data that will best support my kid or my kids.
Sherita says figuring out what to do next will depend on schools and communities knowing what's happening right now. As schools face the unprecedented challenge of sudden closures, Sherita has been quickly gathering feedback from educators through an online survey. She says as the consequences from the outbreak unfold, it's important to set a baseline for what is needed and spot problems early.
To figure out the best ways that we can support, given our resources and platform, to really hear from the community around what actual needs are, and be responsive in that way once we gather some data.
The real consequences, though, might not fully emerge until the fall. Educators in districts and communities that have suffered through decades of disinvestment may be stretched especially thin as they try to ensure students don't slip through the cracks after spending what could be months out of school.
You know, that's one of the main reasons why we have to, like, you know, throughout all of this, pause and consider that. Consider who's going to show up and how we're going to show up in the fall, not just kids, but yeah, like educators. Like, how are educators going to be equipped with what they need to support students who, for the last 3 months of school, quite possibly have missed out on some learning opportunities? So yeah, there are going to be some gaps there. Think about teachers who are going to, you know, show up with these kids in the fall and, you know, have to do the work of support. That's going to be a whole different structure that's necessary, right? That's funding support that we have to think about, because there's going to need to be some other supports for teachers. So whether that's, how do we look at, like, teachers' assistants? How do we look at social workers who are invested and engaged? And to be honest, like, I right now don't have the answer for that. That's why, again, we're trying to gather data. We're trying to see how this is going to play out over time. We're trying to, as far as EdHub goes, stay engaged in conversations with schools and school leaders, paying attention to, you know, policy decisions that are being made, thinking about, you know, them waiving testing. So there's waivers that are happening, so we don't have to worry about state testing this year. Great, but then what does that mean for next year and how, you know, that plays out? So it's certainly top of mind for myself and the folks that I'm working with to gather this data, to follow the trends, to keep tracking, to see how we are going to show up for kids and teachers come late August, early September of this year.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate you. I hope the rest of your day goes well, and I'll be following what you all are doing.
All right, I will keep you informed. You take care of yourself. Stay well.
You too.
It's important to recognize that teachers across St. Louis and beyond, regardless of available resources, are doing their best to navigate uncharted waters, which is why we called Treasure Shields Redmond.
I teach at East St. Louis Senior High School. I run the ninth grade writing lab there.
Before we get to our conversation with Treasure, we want to give our listeners outside of St. Louis a little background on East St. Louis. It was the site of traumatic arson and deadly violence by armed white people against black residents in an event now known as the East St. Louis Race Riot of 1917. But it was also home to greats such as jazz musician Miles Davis, dancer Katherine Dunham, singer-actress Tina Turner, and athlete Jackie Joyner-Kersee. Treasure's father, Eugene Redmond, the poet laureate of East St. Louis, and multidisciplinary artist Damon Davis, co-director of the Who Streets documentary on the Ferguson Uprising, are just some of the people from East St. Louis who are keeping the spirit of creativity, resilience, and community alive. It's the same spirit that Treasure aims to foster in her students. But as Treasure adjusts to remote instruction, she faces the economic reality that 93% of students in East St. Louis are considered low income by the Illinois State Board of Education.
Though the students are just as brilliant and the teachers are just as capable, we're operating within a milieu where people are just in survival mode much more often than young people should have to be.
Treasure says she immediately spotted a contrast in how the sudden closure was handled in East St. Louis compared to the more affluent district her daughter attends in O'Fallon, Illinois.
When my daughter's school was shut down, the assumption was that everyone was connected. There wasn't any offer to check out any devices. Now, on the other hand, at East St. Louis Senior High School, they are staggering days to allow students to come and check out Chromebooks because it's pretty well known that most of the households have spotty Wi-Fi, if Wi-Fi at all, and many people don't have connected devices outside of a cell phone. But I will tell you this, lots of kids have tuned in to my video about I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou. They have a Google Classroom as well as the video lessons that I'm committed to creating each week. So I think the main strategy that I'm employing is leaning into stretching out the educational process and making it more of a natural each day do a little bit type of situation than trying to recreate a 7-class schedule each day.
We asked Treasure what she anticipates when students return to school and what motivates her to press on. And one theme emerged, community.
Today, when my son, my daughter, and my 82-year-old dad and I went grocery shopping, he suggested that we first go to Walmart, and I just flat out refused. I suggested that we go to East St. Louis because what I have noticed is that when a community has a reputation for violence and for poverty, that people from the outside don't come in, and the stores remain well-stocked and cordial and safe. And we went to East St. Louis to a Save a Lot grocery store, and it was calm, quiet. People were sweet. They were smiling. And we were able to get everything we needed except for bread. So my faith in poor and working poor communities remains unshaken.
This show is produced by me, Jalian Yang, and my co-producer, Lauren Brown. This show is overseen by Tim Lloyd, senior producer of On Demand and Content Partnerships, and Robert Peterson, director of radio programming and operations at St. Louis Public Radio. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.